start hooking on the dot, but you know, people come in, they'll come in. I'm Avi Mintz, a producer at Chaos Studios. I was thinking about doing this, but then I decided not to, and then I decided to put it up because people had expressed some interest in project management when you all went around. Obviously, the title was really short and concise, and there's a lot to talk about. So, Nate suggested, it'd be pretty cool to go around the room, everyone kind of give an idea about what they want to talk about when they hear project management, what that means to them. I'm sure we're all in different work environments. We all have different pipelines, different interactions for day-to-day basis. So Chaos, we work with kind of a hybrid of Scrum Agile. I'm actually relatively new to the industry. I've only been a producer for about a year and a half. We switched from Waterfall, which we did our first project in, and so there's a lot of kind of pros and cons that at least I know about. That's what I would be talking about. So that here.
I'm interested in small team management and motivation. We're a team of 7 people, and so how do you keep everyone humming along as efficiently as possible and keep them motivated?
Communicating with outsourced teams. Keeping team motivation and setting deadlines, even though none of us are getting paid.
That's going to be a tough
one. That could be tied in with the managing small teams, I think.
Well, we need to.
Or are you guys getting paid?
Oh,
okay.
But we're also distributed. Can't even give a piece.
But I mean, sure, you could tie that in. Why not?
All right.
That's kind of similar stuff, right?
Okay.
Say again.
Maintaining motivation and keeping deadlines, even though we're working pro bono. I don't know how to make that small.
Yeah.
Motivation and
morale.
Motivation, morale for free.
Yeah.
This is a very important part.
It's in the can.
I
guess.
Yes, there it is.
I'd like to talk a little bit about how people who aren't managers can insinuate themselves creatively into management when they're being ignored, perhaps.
I would also love to talk about that.
Huh?
I'd love to talk about that.
Okay.
I guess tying. How do you put that succinctly?
I think you said it best, though. Wait, sorry. What were you saying?
How do you put that succinctly?
Good communication.
Rising into them.
Creative input from
often
ignored roles, maybe.
Yeah.
Establishing leadership.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, and also maybe the opposite. If you are a manager and someone's not following through on the work, how can you...
Dropping the hammer.
How can you do that without either micromanaging or, you know, being that evil person?
Effective feedback.
Actually, something I'd really like to talk about, and I can talk about this because it's an extremely small project, so there's no ties connected between anyone. But in the project I'm working on right now, I am not getting managed, and I want to get managed. and it's the point where I'm a sound designer, and I say that, like, even artistic management, and I said to her, okay, let's talk about the what you want your game to sound like, and the only feedback or anything I've gotten is I trust your judgment, which is fucking useless.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a thought. Can you, like, come up with a pile of, like, here's 30 YouTube links to different kinds of songs. Can we go through them together and select which ones you like and which ones you don't like?
Give me something, yeah. Teach her a lesson. Your gun sounds like.
But the interesting thing about, if you don't mind if I just start talking, the interesting thing about what you said, it sounds like you're working without any kind of confines, and people need that in order, like, you can't just work in a big box. You need a small box to know what your limits are and what people expect of you. But it also, I think what you're looking for is knowing what to expect from your producer or manager, and then what they should expect from you. And you should probably have a conversation about management expectations.
It's very helpful to have direction when you're working. Otherwise, it's a lot of time you waste time, I think. At least that's what I found, you know, because you make something and then it turns out it's not really what they were looking for. They just didn't know how to tell you what they were looking for.
I'm going to put this up as effective communication of goals and something that we refer to in chaos as user story or acceptance criteria.
Acceptance criteria,
which is probably pretty straightforward.
Well, it also sounds a little bit like, you know, he may need to educate his manager as to what he actually does.
Well, there's two different aspects to that. If I could break it down, it'd probably be a management problem, but also a direction problem. Those are two different roles. When you're in any kind of a work environment, you have the person you report to, and you have the person who manages your schedule. And sometimes that's one and the same, but sometimes it's not. If someone's managing your schedule, it doesn't mean that they know enough to give you input creatively on the music you're making.
Right.
So
like I've blundered into the same situation with audio people before, and it was strictly because I didn't know what they were doing. And so at that point, the audio people I had to educate me on what they do and how they do it in order for me to more effectively manage their timelines.
You also may need to work with other people in the crew who aren't your manager, like people who you think might know something about audio, like, you know, like, maybe the audio, you know, the modeling guy did a stint in audio and just bounce ideas off of him and say, before I send this out, what do you think, dude?
Yeah.
And I would also encourage you to, if your management does not immediately suggest interim mic check and stems, to, you know, go to them and, like, bring it up and suggest it to them. Like, hey, you know, you want me to do this? What about we have, like, these sub-milestones? And, like, I'm going to come up with some ideas and I'll bring you something tomorrow or next week.
Yeah.
So that you don't actually put in all the work and then they suddenly realize, oh, I had in my mind, like, it should sound like the World War II storming of Beach Normandy as interpreted by this 1968 movie that I saw once.
Mm-hmm.
Which they might, in their heart of hearts, that's what they want you
to
produce.
Don't know how to say it.
They don't know how to say
right.
that.
So here's a general question. How many of us here are in our management or production roles and how many not? So management production roles?
Sort of.
What?
Sort of.
Everything.
That's right. Cool. Very interesting. All right. Do you want to add anything that we haven't even mentioned, or do you want to go through these and start talking about them? You can break it down further.
Just start jumping into them, yeah.
All right, cool. So who wants to start? Let's take like pros and cons of, I guess, let's take small team versus big team. It seems to be kind of an interesting break. So...
It's a basic law of entropy. The larger your team becomes, the larger infrastructure and energy you must be put in to maintain the team. Otherwise, it becomes unwieldy and starts to collapse in on itself. By having a larger team, you move towards a requirement of hierarchy. The two models I always use for this are the military model and the fraternity model. Is a military model is, you know, you have this massive organization, several millions of people, and there's this super, the only way it functions is you have this super strict hierarchy. You can talk to who knows this, or you only take orders from here, 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 and here. And these people do not matter, like, in this way. And the other one is fraternity, which, you know, I was in college fraternity, and it's essentially a volumocracy. He who is loudest is right. Where, you know, it's like there is leadership per se, but it's all entirely charisma based. The hierarchy actually means nothing. But, and you know, on one hand, that organization is very good at keeping people happy because everyone gets their say. On the other hand, it also makes you hate democracy a little bit because everything takes forever.
You really brought up small team management and motivation, right?
Mm-hmm. But I was just thinking, you saying scale and agility is like, you know, they start to fall into these two broad spectrums.
So how big is your team?
My team right now is two guys.
Two guys.
So me and I'm a designer, animator, modeler, and my friend is a concept artist and industrial designer. So he is. So I've just been, but you know, he's in Pittsburgh. I'm in Connecticut, and I've been, you know, I've been trying to stay on him because there's, you know, we're early in production. We're still looking for crew members, but you know, and programmers are very hard to come by, especially for projects like ours where there's no money involved. And so I say that good models and good concept art and good game design documents, these in a way are all tools for us to woo programmers over onto our side, and you know, we must seduce them, if you will. And so far we've been not having a lot of luck, and so we need more art assets to show these people that, you know, we are committed, we're not vaporware. And but you know, I've been trying to convey this, and at the same time, you know, for both of us, you know, have regular jobs that we need to deal with, and regular real world stuff we need to deal with. But if we lose our momentum, the project could die.
So I mean, have you guys incorporated? Are you an entity? Because I found that when we were starting up, something that spoke very well to programmers was, we will give you some shit ton of equity. Here is some, like, no joke stake in the company, and when we do well, you're going to do well. And that compensation, I think, does very well when you're not offering money. Have you done that stuff?
No.
I would recommend looking into that.
It does cost, you know, a couple hundred or whatever,
mm-hmm.
depending on...
It does, but then you can
it
say
is,
to them,
I've
we are a for real
it's
company, and here is your stake. You own
it
this
is
much.
It is a...
And programmers and technical people tend to understand the idea of deferred compensation.
If you don't ever intend to make money, though, it's not really worthwhile. You know, if yeah.
I hope that's not.
Yeah, I assume
that
you do intend to make money at some point. Maybe I'm going.
I don't know.
We're a source mod that may show up on Steam. Like, perhaps that equals money. Perhaps it does. For us, it's kind of a labor of love.
I see.
The other big option you have for any thing for incentive is just, I'll use fame for lack of a better word, which is, but really more what it is, it's like a resume builder, which is say, fine, you're not going to get a crap ton of money from this, but when we hit the number one spot on Steam mods, like, that'll be on a page that a million people will see, and you can then, therefore, after that point, say, I did that. And that's actually another big incentive.
There are certain negotiation points that come in with that. I, as a contract artist, get very wary when somebody says to me, we can't pay you, however, this will be great exposure for you.
Sure.
You, you know, that like that just screams I'm trying to scam you. But if you, there's another way to imply the same thing, which is just, you're already working towards that with your artwork and stuff, but just like give them a 3-second splash screen as the game starts up for their company or something like that.
So we've definitely drifted into the motivational part of this, of that statement,
mm-hmm.
which is cool. I mean, obviously. If you want to get back to management, we could do that also. But I mean, I like what you said before about like integration of, you said you were sound, right? You also sound. That's kind of interesting.
Music
specifically.
Yeah.
Okay.
And although I'm working to get into sound, so we'll be in competition soon.
So what's your experience? You're an outsourced music.
Based on what he just said, actually, I have negotiated getting my logo at the beginning of games in compensation for the fact
that
I either wasn't getting paid. Huh?
I stole that directly from
you. Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay. I'd forgotten that I'd already told you about that. But yeah, it was nice. I negotiated, like, it's got to be at least 2 seconds. It's not going to be something that just goes pop, you know. You got to make sure you say that kind of stuff, because I've learned pretty quickly with contracts that if you don't say it, don't assume anything.
Talking about management, you said something interesting earlier that I would love to shift the conversation to if other people are interested, which is you've got someone that's maybe not producing up to the level of what you want and what you'd expect. So what do you do? I would love to talk a bit about that.
To give an example, I have this designer. We have a pretty small team of about 10 people, and we had an offsite art team of, I don't know, 20. But in-house, we had this one designer who is a really good designer, and I can trust everything that comes out of him. The client likes everything that he does. But there's certain things that he just wasn't doing and wasn't following through with. And so it came clear that he didn't know what his role in the project was. So I think it's what I'd like to talk about is, you know, how the importance of setting up people's expectations. expectations so that you don't get into this situation, or if you are in that situation where somebody's, you know, not following through and doing their job, you know, how to approach that and or prevent it.
More specifically than that, that's a good topic. More specifically, I guess, when your organization is currently, when everyone is currently kind of used to being micromanaged, how do you step away from that and, you know, get, you know, establish a framework where people can, you know, work creatively on their own and still, you know, turn out useful stuff, you know, without having to come back to the team lead for every single decision.
I think that ties in really well to what you were talking about. What's your name?
Robert.
Okay, so if you're put in this huge box, you don't know, and you can't be as productive. But if you are given confines and you let the people on your team know that you trust them and that they can do a really good job within, you know, what you're within the scope of what you're supposed to be doing, then people can really be productive, and you don't have to be there micromanaging every single step of the way.
One thing that works really well for that is really extensive pre-production. If everybody knows, like you say, if everybody knows what box they're in, then they could be thinking creatively.
You mean identifying all the assets that are needed, like on a
Not even that, but on a grander scale, everyone knows what this game is, so you don't need to get approval on every single asset because you can.
You know what the game's vision is. You're
right.
Yeah.
Everyone, it's a shared vision rather than a single vision whole.
Yeah.
But I would even say, like, you are responsible for, you know, making sure that the design document is updated every time we have a meeting. You are responsible for that. You are also responsible for communicating when you do make an update to it and letting people know, because sometimes the designer will go and make some updates and say, yeah, this would be really cool, but not communicate to anybody. Well, that's very important. So as long as they know they're supposed to do that, then
they can
be very effective.
From a music standpoint, what I usually do is when I'm first working on a project, I spend a lot of time on one track. And I basically slowly shift it to, like, well, that's not quite what we're looking for. And I try to make a track which I view is if the game has one type of vision. Now, sometimes some games, which I really like, have, like, very eclectic music. But if it has, like, one kind of music, I do my best to kind of just try to find the rhythm that they want throughout the rest of the assets. And that takes a long period of time, but it's well worth it to establish exactly what's wanted from the artist. And that sounds to me like kind of what you need for the sound thing as well.
Yeah.
On the team that I was working with, the audio people were very helpful for me with understanding what it was that I needed to get from our game's visionary in order for them to be able to produce their music. I mean, they wanted, what is he watching when he's creating that level? What is he feeling? Did he create that level while he was watching, some war movie, and then that gets pulled into what he's actually creating, and, you know, making sure it's documented? What are the feelings he wants to be conveyed? So the team that I got to work with, I guess, kind of sounds like I was fortunate from an audio perspective, because I got to do that with them very early on to make sure that in the design document and all the documentation that we made, we had that addressed so the audio team knew what they were doing. And so for me, that's really important, is the documentation.
Yeah.
So that you can do that. Everybody can understand. And it's hard even with the one that we have, because the game that we're making, the designer has a very weird what he's trying to do, and so not everybody understands it, and so that's hard. And we're trying to make it clear in the documentation, and it's still very hard. But to me, that's a number one.
Can I just add something? I think one thing that kind of gets lost in the whole looking at pre-production, and, like, yes, we need good documentation, we need good scheduling and all this, but something that people really need to focus on as well is team building. You need to pick the right people to serve the right roles. And a lot of producers that I've worked for have a huge disconnect between what their expectation of what people can do and what the person's actual ability is. So we'll have artists who are, let's say, more senior artists who have a lot more projects under their belt, but they're not necessarily skilled at doing certain things. Like, they don't ever ask questions. So if there's something that's expected of them, they just kind of make some base assumptions and move ahead with it without actually clarifying what they're expected, what is expected of them. So if the producer isn't making, or the manager, whoever it is, isn't making sure that that person knows what their actual role is and knows how they're supposed to do it, then you're going to have problems there. And it's not something that should just be done in the beginning of a project. It's something that needs to be done throughout as needs and expectations change. If you suddenly add a design spec to your project and you have these new systems going in, you need to figure out who the person is that's going to be the best at putting that in, and then making sure that they have the tools available to them to actually get it done. Otherwise, you're going to lose time, you're going to lose money. People are going to get frustrated because, let's say, I want to do it, and this other guy doesn't really want to do it, but he's being tasked with it. If you're not asking us, we're not going to have the right person on the project.
So to answer kind of what you were asking before, there are two things that came to my mind. One was, in general, the thing I noticed is a problem at multiple places, is too infrequent feedback from like production and management. I've worked at places where there was, everyone's worked at places where there was, annual review, here's annual review time. And I worked at places where that was pretty much the only real feedback you got on how you're performing, which is just awful. Like, because it creates all sorts of, I've moved to the litany of issues it creates. But even having, like, twice a year reviews where they're smaller and quicker and even more specific to the last 6 months that aren't, we're not talking, salary based and like that, but we're talking just like every 6 months, here's 10 minutes of how you can be doing whatever. It's just, I found it to be infinitely more useful in keeping people on track. The other thing I would mention as well is that with regards to someone isn't doing things that, they need to do or so on and so forth, the more specific an example you can give, I've found in the past, like, has helped both me and people who give me feedback and vice versa. So if someone goes, oh, you're not doing these kinds of things, I'm like, okay, I guess I'll try harder at that. You can say, like, for example, on this date you were supposed to send this in and it didn't go in until like 3 days later, and it was like a specific, like, this file on this date, like, and not like an accusatory story, but like a very specific thing, like, oh, I get what you're talking about now. Oh, you're talking about that thing where I have to send off that file, and okay, now I get it. Like, the more specific you can be, I found to be useful. So those are just two thoughts.
I'll bouncing off that a little bit. I'm Aaron Melcher. I used to be the lead game developer over at AMI Entertainment. We even did it even more than that. I was responsible for doing one-on-ones with all my guys bi-weekly. So it's just 30 minutes every 2 weeks with each person. I have 8 guys, so it's pretty much every day I got one. And I would do that with them, and we just establish a feedback loop. This 10 minutes of that 30 minutes is about, how I thought you were doing over the past 2 weeks. Some things I noticed, some things that need construction on, some things that are good. And it's just 10 minutes. The other part of it is, how are you doing? How are things at home? Is everything cool? Because, then you can construct, like, oh, that's why he wasn't so motivated. His wife was crying about something or something like that, And then you'd be like, hey, man, you got to come in. You got to do that. And if you can establish a more active, constructive feedback loop, I found that really helps with, like, because then it's no problem. Like, oh, you messed it. I manage programmers. So, like, you messed up a check-in, man. You need to fix that. You can say that casually in the department, and you establish a good feedback loop, and they don't think you're like a jerk, because it's just like, that's how it is.
Actually, along the line of what I was saying, not even just in terms of like negative criticism or like or constructive criticism, like that, but also in terms of praise. If you can give someone a specific example of something they did that was good, like, oh, that day that you also added this extra feature, even though you didn't need to, and here was the feature, here's the day, that was awesome. That was totally cool. Like, those sorts of things. Like, I just noticed the more specific.
Yeah, that's almost more important than letting them know when they mess up. If you can notice something they did great, then they know to do that more.
One productive producer I worked with at one point actually kept logs where he had a log on every single person he was responsible for. Like, he had a file open, and every single time they did something that was like really awesome, he would make a note about it. Every single time he did something that like wasn't as good, he would also make a note about it. And therefore, if there was ever now time for okay, it's time for reviews, or it's time to do that, whatever. He could go, and he could see, we're talking, a note, once or a couple of days on someone, one-word sentence, something like that, even, it just doesn't make any sense. But anyways, just a couple of words, and I actually found it to be, I'll add one caveat to this. I found it to be very effective. it also is kind of disturbing at times where it's like, well, it was kind of frustrating when you're like, oh, here's the things you've done wrong. Bling. And you're like, oh, come on, are you kidding me? You're like, you can see, so too specific and too much, like, it can just be overwhelming. You're like, oh, like, I came back 5 minutes late for lunch? What, really? Like, you know, you don't want to like be overwhelmed.
And it also defers down to an easy law of leadership is praise in public, criticize in private. If you you know, if you praise in public, you know, people feel good about themselves. But and by criticizing in private, you know, you do not feel, they do not feel like you have embarrassed them or are, you know, or making it personal. It's like you take them aside and say, all right, man, you know, these pieces are coming in really slowly and we need to move quicker. Whereas if you do that in private, that's sort of, you know, people can take that very personally very quickly.
I'm gonna put it a little bit in terms of, like, I mentioned Scrum Agile at the beginning. As a person who's seen different, I guess, workflow implementations, identifying a lot with a lot of the things that people have said, something that Scrum does, not to, like, kind of promote this methodology, but it seems to work with a lot of the problems we've mentioned here. Communication is, I think, one of the basic pillars of any interaction. I guess centralized communication is what works, or seems to work for me best. The nice thing about Scrum is that it first of all, you mentioned, I think, teams, small teams, and kind of giving people the room to do what they need to do in like a very close environment. And so our team's pretty big. We have like 100 plus people, and you guys are even bigger, I think, right? And what we do is we break it down to teams of 7 or so, and those are called Scrum teams. And they work in increments, which is like every 2 weeks. And that allows for a feedback loop. We were talking about, you know, giving people positive or negative reinforcement. There's a centralized review after 2 weeks of everything that team has done. And the praise happens in public.
Yeah,
and,
it's like a show and tell.
Yeah, it's a show and tell. You know, you get to show off whatever feature you've made and talk a little bit about it. You get to show off any cool art you've done and content. And then we have 15 minutes afterwards where the team sits down with just their managers and we talk about things that went well, things that didn't go so well, ways we can improve things for the future. That can cover anything and everything that you guys mentioned.
Well, how have you guys, or not even sure if you have, overcome upper management's basic fear of Scrum implementations because they allow that, or they have to allow that Scrum team to self-manage? How, or have you guys been able to overcome that?
So it's an ongoing fight. I think it has to be in any work environment, just because what you essentially do by giving that, you know, you were talking about expectations and then giving someone a task and come back afterwards and trying to reevaluate where you're at and make sure that they've done what you've asked them to do. And if you give a team something to work on, like 7 guys for 2 weeks, you come back 2 weeks later, they could have made something totally different than what you expected. And that's just a break in communication. What it comes down to really is, as a manager, it's your responsibility to maintain a link with the team, make sure that, you know, that you're viewing their work and that you're seeing what they're doing. And as soon as something starts going off track, you can kind of get in there and just say, hey, wasn't exactly part of the task, and part of that is managing, acceptance criteria to begin with. If you give someone a very clear communication, you know, like I want this kind of person to be able to use this feature in this way, you know, and this is the final result, just called a user story. You know, then you have a very clear idea. So you were asking, you know, management, how do they let go, or if they do let go, or how do you?
Yeah, I think I'm going a little more basic than where you're thinking right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like where I last was. They attempted to implement Scrum in probably the most half-assed manner I've ever seen because the first time they did it, the team decided they wanted to work noon to 2 a.m. And so people would start trickling in at noon. There were concerns, you know, because the president, he sees people coming in late, he sees empty offices, and he doesn't understand. Production, you know, provides him with all the information he needs, and he still puts a kibosh on it because they're not here at 9 a.m. and they're not leaving at 5 p.m., so it's obviously bad. How do you overcome that?
Well, that's pretty specific.
Last place I was, I saw it. But many other places I've seen it, ranging from companies like Franklin Templeton to just other places. My background is mostly in enterprise, so you know, I see it all over.
Yeah.
People attempting Scrum, but not actually doing it.
Scrum doesn't mean the team just gets to do whatever they want. I mean, you know, like,
a big basis of it is self-management.
It's self-management, but still, you can put a box around it and say, here's your, you have some big limitations, you have to wear clothes, you know, or something like that. you can't, I mean, it's not just like, do whatever you want,
what,
you know, like all of a sudden. Like, I feel like maybe that's what the company thought Scrum was, and that's why they had issues with it. It sounds like
Scrum is a way to manage workflow. It's not necessarily a way to manage office guidelines. You know, if the idea of fostering a team environment is something that you really treasure and want to, you know, promote as one of the pillars of your studio or your, you know, development community, then it makes sense for everyone to be there at the same time. Right. So you know, that's I think kind of different.
This falls into the range of acceptance in that it's like you go to the guys like, all right guys, I know you really want to show up at noon and leave at 2 a.m. but at the same time, that's not really your province to decide. You need to be talking with the HR people and the management folks, because you know there are reasons that these guys are supposed to show up at noon and leave at 5. You know, there's a very acceptable reason for this. And so you know, if you guys want to talk it over with them, sure, but you know, talk it over with them first. So this is like a this is like the communication thing all over again, where the Scrum team is, I hate to use this word, but they're kind of almost more like a union than anything else. You know, they're a self-managing group that like work as a cohesive unit, but they're not their own company.
So I had two quick questions. One was for those of you that have used like various agile methods in the past, I know 2 weeks is like the somewhat standard. But I've worked on projects where that was just not really, like, things just didn't break down as easily. And we had to try, like, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, and we tried, like, fluctuating it. I was just wondering if anyone who's working in agile, like, Scrum-based methods has had any input on, like, durations. And the second quick question was, you said you worked previously, they switched from Waterfall to Scrum. And I was just curious what your opinion on, like, the pros and cons of the change was. Those are two random questions.
Okay. Anyone else work on
Kind of going on, I guess, bouncing kind of like switching from regular traditional to Scrum. The company, the way they did it at my company, thankfully the guy in charge of technology, he was really pushing it and he was out there. But there was, you know, there was the CEO and stuff above him, and it actually took him like 2 years to get it to actually get fully implemented. He just took baby steps with them and compromised them. Okay, we're going to do stand-ups, your daily stand-ups. We'll do that for a while, see how that goes, and then, you know, you can see like stuff getting done. And then eventually now we're doing month sprints. So I mean, you can kind of do it like you gotta get their buy-in to be able to do it. And if there's one department on Scrum, like you have to get all the departments on Scrum, and that can be really difficult too. When you know, getting marketing on there, getting people doing design documents on there, and all that. That's how we did it.
So to answer your second question and touch on what you mentioned earlier about I guess management, the change from Waterfall to Scrum, and in my opinion at least, seemed to be most beneficial in two different ways. One was communication, just the fact that, you know, we had 2 people talking to level designers, talking to programmers all at the same time every day. Was just a monumental change. It was something that I had done previously, but it was a very unofficial thing, and I had to go from desk to desk and you know, try and piece everything together, and it just makes a lot more sense having one in one room. A little tough sometimes to break down the barriers of communication. Some people don't like talking, but yeah, that was probably one of the biggest things. In a management role, it's very easy to get caught up with micromanaging your people, and I think one of the downfalls of Waterfall, that's a pun of some sort, is that you have one person who might want to take control of something, and they might be responsible for something, and what they end up doing is going up to people's desks and you know, standing on people's shoulders and just directing them, you know, on a day-to-day basis in a way that's really obstructing any kind of creative process from the team side. But the nice thing about having a team of people who are quote unquote you know, set free to do as they please for 2 weeks is that they're given boundaries, they're given clear communicate, the goals are clearly communicated to them, but the way that they reach those goals is up to them. And they're allowed to kind of to experiment and create the things they want to create, at the same time achieving those goals that have been communicated to them up front. So it's a little hard sometimes, I think, for a lot of managers to let go in that respect, and sometimes, you know, someone needs to be there to fend them off and say, it's going to be here, give it 2 weeks, we'll talk about it, you know, or a month. We'll give it, you know, we'll do a review then, we'll see where things are at. As far as 2 weeks, a month, 6 weeks, I think we're still experimenting.
Two weeks has
definitely become too short for most of our teams, because the kickstarting of a sprint cycle takes effort, takes planning, and it's just when you have 12, 13 sprints running at the same time consecutively, it just doesn't make sense. It's too much time invested in planning and not enough time invested in actual implementation.
That's been the biggest problem I've seen with most Scrum implementations, has been simply that having difficulty of breaking down the various like tasks to things. different and can't really be broken down, or it's too small, and you're like, okay, so that's one thing now, but now the other things don't fit right. Like, that's just been like the number one problem that I least perception had. And also, has anyone here done like the whole planning poker thing?
Yeah.
Anyone talking about that at all?
Yeah.
So, can anyone, other than the stupid Fibonacci numbers, is anyone like, which literally make me want to like tear my hair out? Like, does anyone have come up with a better planning poker method?
Can you explain what planning poker is?
Yeah.
Okay. In about 10 seconds, you have your team at the start of a sprint, and you're planning out the tasks. You know, who's been doing what, and all sorts of things like that for this sprint. The team each gets cards that have numbers on them. It's supposed to rate the relative complexity of the task, which is not necessarily duration. It gets weird because I was using several different definitions of how to do it properly, as for every single thing related to the Agile. And so basically the idea is that you have all your tasks now, and on a given task, everyone on the team takes a card from their little, the number, and each card's like a 1, 2, 3, 5, whatever, there's a bunch of numbers, and that's the kind of the question I'm asking. And it says, okay, 1, 2, 3, go, and everyone shows what they think that relative value, relative complexity of that task is. And then if there's a wide disparity, if there's like disparity, you know, everyone puts down 10. Like, it's very clear, okay, that task is a 10, you know, and everyone puts down 2, that task is a 2. And then you can kind of, like, then, as tasks are being assigned or claimed by various people, you know, you can say, like have a relative, you know, complexity. You can use duration, it's a whole weird thing. In any case, the numbers are most frequently used in all the stupid management books is the Fibonacci, Fibonacci numbers. So 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, or something. I actually see them completely bastardized to, 21 and, 50 or some random like that. The idea is that you get a lot of range at the high end, and so people aren't arguing, is that an 8 or a 9? And trying to split hairs. The idea is that it's like there's a lot of.
You could do logarithmic.
I mean, so we did that for a while, and maybe we just had a bad implementation, but I think it's a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Nobody actually. You tried to explain what we call story points, and you didn't even touch on the reason for it. Basically, it's something. It's a production tool, without a doubt. It's a producer tool. 100%. The idea is to gauge the amount of work that can be done within a certain amount of time.
Yes.
So if you can complete, I don't know, I'm going to say 50, then we try and give you 50. And that's based on a historical value, which is how many story points you've completed up until then. It's purely meant to gauge velocity of a certain team and be able to assign work correctly to them, essentially projecting the end date of a project or a milestone accurately, or as accurately as possible. And it's the other way to do it, a lot of people have done, we do, which is sometimes time, just straight up time estimates.
Right.
Time estimates can get very hairy, though. Any programs in here? I don't need to tell you guys. We're just going to look at that code and probably just change a little bit. It'll fit it right in, and doesn't much.
Yeah, it'll probably work.
Do you think that's actually effective with your team, though? I can imagine about half the people on my team, if I ever tried to do anything like that, would roll their eyes and hate it and regret every minute sitting in that meeting and not want to do it.
So everyone kind of my experience was everyone kind of thought it was dumb at start and hated it at start. The area I was actually most affected in was not even the over we did end up using was not even so much the the whole story points of like you can now see that this scrum team and this scrum team like this they're operating at 50 story points a week and they're operating at 75, but they each have their own definition of what story points are, so which is kind of some weird or individuals. The thing we actually found to be affected in was we were, as a team, self-tasking. We would make the task list for a sprint, and then we were kind of amongst ourselves figuring out who was going to do what. It wasn't assigned to us. We were all figuring out who was going to do what. Prior to doing that, we then gave a relative value of how hard we thought these things were. So basically the thing was all right, so that thing is going to be a giant, huge thing to do. That's going to take the whole 3 weeks to do. That thing can all probably be done within 3 weeks. And it was basically so getting those relative values before we then sat down and said, all right, you know what, Fred, I'll take that one and that one. And then I was like, okay, I'll take that one and that one. And it was getting more relative quantities of work like that was more agreed upon a group, so you don't feel like that guy just took, you know, 3 weeks to do something I can do in a day, you know, whereas I'm like stuck with this, you know, I've got 2 weeks to do something that's going to take me a month, you know, like it wasn't that level of, that's what we did find it effective. The whole actual like little game of it is dumb, but it goes by so, like once you've done it a couple times, the whole thing took like, it was so quick. So the meeting, like the first time we did it, it was a long painful process, because the hardest part of it is actually when you have the negative disparity, when one guy says this is 20, one guy says this is a 3, you have to then discuss and be like, all right, why does this guy think this is so much harder than this guy? Frequently, and then, which is actually, and that actually was the other area, actually surprisingly valuable, because then it gets a lot more clarity to what those tasks are. Because this guy thinks like, oh, I want you to design the whole zone. This guy's like, oh, I want you to design one castle. You know, it's like, oh, I see where, like, okay, now we can, like, they clarify what the task is.
Okay, well,
I did actually have one other question, if that's okay. I'm wondering how, I've never been on the production side of things, I've always been on the development side of things, or whatever you want to describe it as. And there's always a lot of complaining on our end of things about the fact that we don't feel producers really listen to our feedback on their performance. So what is a good way for an employee to describe to their manager how they can be managed better?
Well, doesn't that also, I wrote a little note down what you said, it was criticized in private, and you know, producers just get yelled at a lot, so
so employees should yell at them as well?
No, I'm saying employees do yell at producers all the time. So like hearing criticism from people is not all that constructive, because it just happens. But like, I think knowing that you're actually doing an okay job sometimes too would really help.
Okay.
But just talking to people, like, frankly, I mean,
well, what if it somehow got turned into if you tried doing it this way, it would help me so much. But like, maybe that would turn it around a little bit. Like, you're giving them feedback on how to better.
I'm quite wary of that double speak kind of stuff. I start hearing stuff like that, and I'm like, this is some bullshit.
Also, the biggest part about that is that you're essentially telling someone else how to be a producer, and then that's kind of like.
I mean, it does all vary depending on who you're talking to, but because there's people that I don't realize that that's your preferred method of how to do things, and it just goes back to people.
But that goes both ways. Producers try and tell me how to do my job all the way.
That's bad.
But it's
right.
I think also it's a matter of specifics. You know, if I'm overseeing some concept art, I say, okay, this waist is too thin. Move the foot here. You know, things like that. I'm giving specific criticism. I'm not saying make it springier.
You're
you know,
not
that's
you don't make things very springy.
Yeah. Whereas, if a producer and someone says like micromanage me less, like that's really vague feedback. In all honesty, if someone comes to me and says, "Okay, dude, we're right now. You're meeting with me every other day. That's a pain in the ass. Can we meet every week? Can we give that a shot? Like that is specific.
Mm-hmm.
That is helpful. That will reach a solution. That's not, you know, out in the ether kind of bullcrap."
Actually, something I think personally is a big deal. Transparency between tasks, so producers are always aware of the tasks of, you know, their managees.
Ideally.
And there's a very clear transparency there. I think pretty much everything we talk about here is about managing tasks of developers and not of producers. It's an interesting phenomenon is that it's very rare that you see producers actually line up their tasks and show what they're doing with their day. And obviously, I guess kind of complicated sometimes, just like, you know, meeting the clock. but I think that helps. Get to see like what it is that we're doing and how we're spending our time, and can in that case give feedback specifically on the things that we're doing, like, hey, instead of spending, you know, 5 hours in meetings today, maybe we could have sat down and, you know, clarified this, or, you know, something like that. I don't know, I found that to be helpful.
Just kind of expounded on what both people said. What she said, actually do think that'd be a really good idea, and that if you can make it about like the, you know, the role of production in every company I work for has been to help the employees do what they need to do and make sure, rather than like yell at them for more often, you know, than not doing what they do. It's more like rather than, why don't you ever give me pencils, you bastard? Like, all right, to do my job efficiently, I need pencils. You know, like if you can make it about doing your job better.
I love that point. I really
so that's
yeah.
that's the best way I've seen of feeling, like asking a user for anything.
Yeah.
So.
And more the next day, you will have 1,000 pencils.
If they're a good producer, you now catalog your thing of pencils. Mm-hmm. And they're like, which one would help you best? You know, like that's
the efficient producer gives you all the mal and says from the tile.
The .com bubble's over, so that doesn't happen.
Before we go, we did just to bounce off what we were talking about very early on when talking about managing audio. On the board there is the IGDA Audio SIGs kind of introduction. It's brand new and it's aimed at developers. We may not be clear about the board, but really we just want to know how we can help developers interface with their audio team and create a good environment like that. So if anybody's interested in that, please come back.